All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Dale Thronberry.
Good afternoon and welcome to Veterans Radio. My name is Dale Thronberry. I was a chief warrant officer in the United States Army. I flew helicopters in Vietnam in 1969. I want to welcome you to our program here. Today's program is going to be really fun. We're going to be talking about Top Gun. We've got an author of a new book celebrating the 50 years of naval air superiority, although I think my guests might not agree with that. Also in the studio joining me is a retired Major General, William Henderson. He was a Marine pilot during the Vietnam era, and we're going to be talking about his experiences in Vietnam as a pilot, and hopefully he and Dwight can tell a few war stories between them about the different types of aviation that are out there during the time of the Top Gun and also, of course, a jet aircraft in Vietnam. I want to make sure that we tell everybody that we are sponsored by Legal Help for Veterans. Legal Help for Veterans is a disability attorney's office that helps veterans with their claims. You can find them at legalhelpforveterans.com. Also, U.S. Wings, manufacturers of the finest leather flight jackets down in Hudson, Ohio. You just go to uswings.com. I want to remind you to sign up for our raffle, I guess you could call it, a giveaway of a leather jacket that we do on the last Sunday of every month when we have our benefits program. So if you go to our website at veteransradio.net, you can add your name to the list, and hopefully we can get you, maybe we'll pick you this time. So make sure that you do that. Also, we'd like to thank our sponsors, the American Legion Post 46 in Ann Arbor, Michigan, the VVA Charles Kettles, Chapter 310 in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and the VFW Post 423 also in Ann Arbor, Michigan. If you'd like to become a sponsor of Veterans Radio and help us spread the word, as we say, you can find more information about that on our website, veteransradio.net, or you can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, all those other forms of social media that I don't know a whole lot about, but I know that we can get some messages out and let you do that. So what I want to do is I want to take a real quick break, and when we come back, we're going to be talking with Dwight Zimmerman, who is the author of Top Gun, 50 Years of Naval Air Superiority. You're listening to Veterans Radio. All right, we're playing Anchors Away there. I wasn't sure exactly which anthem I should play when we're talking about Top Gun, because the book is Top Gun, 50 Years of Naval Air Superiority, and it talks about aviation in general from World War I on. And it's a great read, and I want to welcome a frequent guest to Veterans Radio, and that is Dwight Zimmerman. Dwight is author of many books, many military books, actually. He was one of the founders and president of the Military Writers Society of America. And just a good friend of ours. He did a review of books on Veterans Radio a few years ago, and that's what kind of introduced me to a Military Writer Society. But I want to welcome back to Veterans Radio Dwight John Zimmerman. Welcome back, Dwight.
Dale, it is so nice to be back here. Thank you so much, and happy Father's Day to all the fathers who are listening.
That's true. Happy Father's Day to all of us, right? Had my breakfast with the fam this morning. Everything went well. I hope you did. Hope you did, yes. Too.
Well, not so much.
Not so. No celebration yet.
We did it a little earlier in the weekend because our son was, having to do a travel.
Another obligation. They always have obligations.
Exactly.
Who let our kids grow up?
it happens.
It does. That is for sure. Well, Dwight, I wanted to I want you to meet my other guest who's in the studio, and let me kind of give a little introduction to him. He's retired Major General William Henderson and Bill, and he is and was an F-4 fighter pilot in Vietnam, Marine, and he's here to kind of act as my expert we talk a little bit about some of the airplanes that are in your book. So, Bill, meet Dwight. Dwight, meet Bill.
Dwight, it's good to be here on the show with you, and looking forward to a very interesting conversation. I looked at the book, and I told Dale I definitely want to get. I'm going to have a copy of that book. It looks like something I want to have.
Well, General, that is a great thing to hear. I am so humbled by that because as someone who, you know, is a lifelong civilian, but, you know, from childhood on, respected, admired the military, was, I grew up reading military history and wanted to do something that, you know, would contribute to it. And, when I became an adult and I had the opportunity to write, the military books, as, Dale can, you know, tell you, this is my 17th, book on military history.
Oh, outstanding. Well, I'll tell you, I'm, again, not familiar with the others, but just through perusing through this one, this is a first-class book. A lot of great pictures and a lot of narrative, so I'm definitely going to pick it up.
Well, thank you. I had a lot of fun with this. And, you know, obviously the original purpose was to, we were looking at, you know, the 50th anniversary of the Navy's, you know, fighter pilot training program, which came to be known as Top Gun, you know, and with the Tom Cruise Top Gun movie sequel coming out, it, you know, seemed like a nice dovetail. And but as I was putting this whole thing together, as it happened when I was working on my Uncommon Valor book, which was about the Medal of Honor recipients from Afghanistan and Iraq, and recognizing that people, because there so much time had passed between the last real recipients of the Medal of Honor from Vietnam, with respect to Shugart and Gordon and the Mogadishu thing, you know, the civilian authors, the civilian audience, I'm sorry, had lost what was the meaning of the Medal of Honor. So we included, you know, a history of the Medal of Honor to put it into context. As I was putting together this Top Gun story, I said, well, the, you know, civilian audience really doesn't know, well, what in the heck does this really mean?
Right.
Why is Top Gun so, you know, important? Why are fighter pilots so special? Mm-hmm. And that's where I, you know, wanted to include a history of fighter pilots and to put into context the whole ethos of being a fighter pilot and why they are such extraordinary individuals.
Well, you've done an excellent job. And again, I'm looking forward to getting the book and reading it from cover to cover. But I'm really impressed with what I've seen so far.
Well, thank you.
Well, yeah, it's as an F-4 pilot himself, we had a very lively discussion on the attributes of the F-4 and the strengths and weaknesses of it. And I think that you did an excellent job in your book of talking about not just the F-4, obviously, but all the other aircraft that you mentioned starting in World War One. And I want to do, Dwight, if we can, kind of go back chronologically and talk about some of these fighter pilots that I think the audience might be interested in. And as you say, maybe rekindle some interest in what these fighter pilots really do. How about that?
Okay, well, I'm happy to, you know, do that. What was really fascinating for me was World War One. Obviously, that was, you know, the first war in which air combat, you know, occurred. And it is really amazing when you start looking at, you know, what all happened, how dangerous. I mean, yes, air combat is dangerous by definition.
Yes.
So, but when you look at what the pilots, in World War One were facing, it wasn't just against their, their adversary. It was the planes themselves. These were very fragile aircraft. And one of the points that I wanted to make visually was, and I was really happy when I found that, I have a photograph in there of the cockpit of a French Nieuport fighter plane, and you're looking at the thing, and you're saying, there's absolutely almost no instruments in there.
No, there weren't any, and they... And the helicopter wasn't that much better, but the it looked like an old car,
Yeah.
There's no speedometer. There's no airspeed. There's no artificial horizon. All the different things that pilots are so used to today, but they got them up in the air. In fact, I don't know how they stayed up in the air most of the time, or even how they figured out how to coordinate machine gun fire with the propellers and all the other things. And you've got some great stories inside your book. We are talking here on Veterans Radio with Dwight Zimmerman, who is the author of Top Gun 50 Years of Naval Air Superiority. And he goes back and he looks at the history of aviation and military aviation specifically. And those planes were, Wright brothers types of things, they're lucky they stayed up in the air more than 15 seconds.
Yeah, and initial air combat was pilots, had pistols, shotguns. They even threw rocks, and grenades at each other, in that. And the first machine guns that were mounted, just above the engine, they wrapped metal around the propellers, because they, machine guns weren't synchronized. So you can well imagine, they're pulling the trigger, and then suddenly, bang, 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 and bullets are flying hither and yon, and maybe a couple are actually, went forward. But who knows, how many, went, elsewhere and even backwards.
You get wounded by your own ricochet.
Right.
We're talking about friendly fire in the worst way.
that's pretty bad. So who was the first American ace? And I'm going to ask you to define ace for our audience.
Okay, well, the first numbers. American ace, I don't think I could tell you. But, these pilots were out there. They captured the everyone's imagination, and it came to be a standard. Initially, it was the downing of 10 aircraft that gave you the title, and the French were the first to give the designation of ace. And it was only after the Americans entered the war in World War One in 1917 that the Allies, Britain and France, said, let us put the designation at 5 planes to make an ace, because it was at that point that you received a decoration. In France it was the Croix de Guerre, and then you got other decorations as well. And as it turned out, we had a number of really good American pilots. It started with the Lafayette Escadrille, which was a group of American pilots who fought, under, the French Air Force. And then when America entered the war, they were signed on, to the American Air Corps. And Raoul Luftberry, who was our top ace at the time, he was French-American. And he taught Eddie Rickenbacker how to fight. And Rickenbacker, as some of our listeners may know, is our World War One ace of aces with 26 kills.
Right. And I was just going to give you that number, because I'm reading it in this amazing book that I've got sitting here on my desk as we're talking. And the French ace of aces was René, and I don't speak French at all, so it's Fonck, F-O-N-C-K. And this gentleman...
You did well.
Oh, well, thank you. This guy had confirmed 75 kills and another 67 that were listed as probables.
Wow.
I think we just impressed the general here with this guy's flying ability. And, of course, inside the book, you also mentioned, you know, the Red Baron and some other people that are, you know, were well known, and how the American public became so enamored with these fighter pilots, especially after the end of World War One. And as you mentioned, throughout the book, you are talking about the influence of Hollywood on recruiting.
Oh, it was manifest. These fighter pilots became, you know, the Knights of the Sky. Mm-hmm. And even before the end of World War One, stories were being written, you know, short stories in magazines and books were coming out, and Hollywood, you know, no fools them, were quick to capitalize on it. And arguably the most famous, I mentioned a number of movies in there, but really the big one was the original King Kong movie. And it was really funny. I got into the background of that, and it was fascinating to see how the producer of the film fooled the chief of naval operations to trick them to actually get a squadron of pilots to do the flying around the Empire State Building and staging the attack on King Kong.
Right. It was not a model.
No.
They were real airplanes flying around pretending to attack the Empire State Building. Yeah, I can remember that movie. I watched King Kong, I don't know, about 100 times on the old $1 million movie and in New York.
Yes.
But of course, that, and for movie buffs out there, there's the movie Wings. That was and all that was pretty much live action. You know, they didn't use They didn't
and
use
it, it defined how to do aerial combat for the movies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was a pretty high.
In modern times, this Top Gun, it was a major recruiting tool. The interest in becoming fighter pilots in the military after Top Gun came out went up exponentially. It had a major effect.
You're quite right, General. I was talking with a friend of mine who was Craig Simons. He at the time was the head of the chair of the History Department at the U.S. Naval Academy, and when that movie came out, and he said there was a huge spike in recruitment, and of course here are all these young men coming out of the movie, and they're all pumped up with adrenaline and saying, "Wow, I'm going to be a fighter pilot," and everything like that, and they sign up, and General. What's the difference between what Hollywood depicted and what it really takes to be a fighter pilot?
Well, it's a big difference. What you see in the movies is the end result of the fighter pilot training, but what you have to go through for that in the Air Force for 12 months and the Navy Marine Corps for 18 months, it's a lot more mundane, a lot more... less exciting, let's put it, for great parts of it.
A lot of repetition.
Right. And there's a lot of pressure because every flight is like a final exam. Mm-hmm. So, but it's well worth it. And there are some exciting times also in flight training when you formation flying and gunnery and that. But a lot of it is instrument training, for example, is very can be boring, very intensive. It's a long like a month and a half program, as I recall, but it's been a long time for me. But what you see in the movies is the end result, which is that part is exciting. but getting there is not that exciting.
Half the fun.
Well, especially when you have to go through the spin and puke chair.
Right. Yeah, a lot of hard work.
It is a lot of hard work, and we're talking with Major General William Henderson here, and Dwight Zimmerman, who is the author of a new book entitled Top Gun: 50 Years of Naval Flight Training. And you talk about, from a historical perspective, we're going from World War I and we're up to World War II, where now we're doing all of these aircraft carrier landings, and we'll mention that later on with the general. He had so much fun doing that.
Yeah, I bet you did. At night, especially.
Yeah, exactly.
He was mentioning that the last portion of your flight training was carrier landing, correct?
In the last portion in the basic training and then last portion in advanced, yes.
And if you messed up your landing?
Right. If you didn't, you could have been, like I tell people, the ace of the base, but if you didn't, when it came time to go to the carrier, if you didn't qualify, there was no second chance. You were out of the program. It wasn't like, well, we'll go back and train some more and you come back out again next month. It didn't matter what kind of grades you had prior to that. If you couldn't get aboard the carrier, you were out. Just that simple.
That's a lot of taxpayer money going to training. And they say, well, see you later, bye.
Right.
No, I know.
Yeah, you had the different arresting cables.
Oh, yeah.
So you were graded as to which ones you'd hit. I think that our listeners would be interested in that aspect, which you would know a lot more than me.
Well, the number three wire is the desirable one.
Wires on there?
I can't remember. It's three or four. It's been a while, but it's three or four. But number three was like the
ideal.
The ideal. However, from a pilot's point of view, it doesn't matter which wire you get. You just want to get a wire. And at the end, it didn't matter if you got all ones or all fours, you qualified. So that the three-wire was nice, but from the guys going out there doing it, they actually could care less about which wire it was.
I'm sure. I just heard recently about landing types, and there are good landings and there are great landings.
Right.
A good landing is a landing that you can walk away from
safely.
A great landing is one that you can walk away from and they can actually reuse the aircraft.
Right.
Well, I'll leave you two guys to talk about that. I'm sure, Dale, you have your anecdotes as a helicopter pilot.
Well, just at one quarter of the speed. That's the only difference, or maybe a tenth of the speed. But we have about 3 minutes, Dwight, before we're going to hit the bottom of the hour. Let's talk just briefly about the effects of the movie Top Gun. As we mentioned, it increased enlistment in the flight programs. In your book, you mentioned that there was actually a Navy recruiter that was opened right next to a couple of movie theaters.
Catch them as they
came out.
As it turned out, when the movie started getting some real buzz and legs, the Navy was quick to seize on it, and they would set up kiosks at big theaters in major markets, like Los Angeles, New York, Chicago, the big cities. And when the young men came out, they would see these recruiting kiosks, and they're in their late teens, early 20s, and they're figuring, hey, I can be the next Tom Cruise or Val Kilmer. And the Navy was smart enough to say, you sure as hell can, just sign right here.
Now, didn't all pilots have to have college degrees?
When I first, in 66, when I went through flight training, they still had a program in the Marine Corps and the Navy called MARCADS and NAVCADS, 2 years of college.
Okay.
But that ended in 66. After that, everybody had to have a four-year degree.
Okay.
Yeah.
Which is why the Army went to the warrant officer program so that they could get the number of pilots that they needed.
Right,
in a short amount of time.
Yeah, exactly.
Kind of busy. Right. We got about a minute and a half to go. Okay. Let's talk in a minute, I guess we can do this, is a transition from prop-driven aircraft to jet aircraft. Now, this occurred between World War II and Korea, correct?
Correct.
Okay. And did this change the training at all, as far as you know? I mean, going from the props to everything else?
I can't address that, because when I came through, it was all jets, okay, except for the first 2 months in a prop, small prop.
Okay. Well, we got to take a break anyway, so we'll think about that question, and I'll make sure that I'm not being a good lawyer today where I don't know the answer to the question before I ask it. We've been talking, and we will be talking more in a moment with Dwight Zimmerman, the author of the book Top Gun, the first 50 years of naval air superiority, and Major General William Henderson, United States Marine Corps. And so you're listening to Veterans Radio, and we will be back in just a moment. Welcome back to Veterans Radio. My name is Dale Thronberry, and I'm getting your host today. And we're talking with author Dwight Zimmerman, whose new book is just out. It's called Top Gun, 50 Years of Naval Air Superiority. And joining me in the studio is retired Major General William Henderson, who was an F-4 pilot in Vietnam. And we're just talking during the break about a number of other aircraft that he's flown. So we're going to get into that in a little bit as we continue on with our chronological look at Top Gun. So, Dwight, tell me what happened in World War II, I think it was. That's where we ended up with some more aces, didn't we?
Well, that was, you could say, excuse me, the golden age of aerial combat. We saw so many advances, you know, in the technology. We went from airplanes fashioned from cloth and wood and primitive machine gun use to all metal, enclosed cockpit, powerful engines, and at the end of the war, we actually had jet engines, in combat. Mm-hmm. It was really an amazing, when you look at how quickly, aircraft were designed and constructed and put into combat, nowadays, it takes, more than 10 years, from drawing board, well, now it's computer, to final product. We were seeing aircraft, in World War One, it was months, from drawing board to actual, fighter plane. And similarly, in World War Two, the accelerated pace of aircraft development was just absolutely amazing. My jaw dropped when I was seeing how quickly all of the major combatants developed their fighter planes
quickly,
in such big numbers.
Right.
The numbers of airplanes were unbelievable. We'll never see anything like that again.
No, I can't imagine doing that. I mean, we're right down the road from Willow Run, where they were turning out, 1,000 B-17s or 24s, whatever it was, toward the end of the war. And I think the ability to produce these aircraft obviously led to our victory in World War II.
They built 5,000 B-24s at Willow Run. Yeah. 5,000 and something, 5,000 plus.
Yeah, it's an amazing number. You're right.
Well, when we went to, so we had, as you said, it was the golden age of fighter pilots and so forth during World War II because everything seemed to be. Now, most of those fighter planes were not pressurized, so they weren't flying at 20, 30,000 feet.
No, interestingly enough, the only pressurized aircraft was the B-29 Super Fortress. And you know, ultimately what happened was instead of it flying at the higher altitude necessitated by being pressurized, they wound up flying at low level in their attacks against Japan.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, we're talking about classic dogfighters, from at the highest 15,000 feet, down to ground level.
Well, I was curious about that, and I wanted to ask the general a question about the pressure suit, because the idea of all these G's on your body, I think that's probably another test that you had to pass mm-hmm. from a physical standpoint. Tell me what it was like to fly with a pressure suit on.
Well, it wasn't really a pressure suit. You wore a G suit,
okay,
which was from it covered your lower part of your stomach and then your legs. And it was had a hose that hooked plugged into the airplane. And when you pulled G's, a certain amount of G's in a turn or whatever, you would feel the bladders in that G suit start to fill up. And fill up to different levels. Now, if you're really pulling hard, it'd fill up to the maximum extent. But what that did was it kept the blood from pooling in the lower part of your body.
Oh, okay.
Now, as soon as you stop pulling G's, it would deflate again. But so it would inflate, deflate as based on the number of G's you pulled. But that just protected the bottom or kept your blood from going pooling in the bottom part of your body. When they start wearing full pressurized suits is when you get up in the 45, 50, 50,000 range altitude and above, which none of the fighter pilots are doing that. So it's a G, and that's the same thing they wear today, same G suit.
Okay, and a G is basically your body weight
right. Multiplied
by however many that you're pulling.
Yeah, right, by a force of gravity.
Okay.
And most airplanes at that time, you could pull about 6 Gs. I think people started passing out around 7 or 8 Gs. But when each airplane had a G limit. So if you over-G'd the airplane, pulled more than, say, 6 Gs, then that airplane had to be inspected when it came back.
Pieces would start flying.
Right.
Yes.
And I'm sure the newer airplanes, I know they have G limits, and it may be more, probably is more, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, that was the only pressurized type suit. It was the G suit.
Okay. I don't like to do this, but I'm going to kind of skip over Korea and get to Vietnam time period, because this is where there's so many changes in tactics and aircraft that occurred there. So, Dwight, let's talk a little bit about what was going on at the beginning of the Vietnam War in the 64-65 era.
Basically what happened was Korea was the last gasp of the true dogfighting era.
Mm-hmm.
When we had the F-86 Sabre, which was our last true dogfighting fighter craft, the advances with jet-powered aircraft caused a reassessment of tactics. And generally, I'm sure you're very familiar with the new training that was implemented at the start of the 1960s that carried into the Vietnam War, in which instead of being a dogfighting fighter, the aircraft was an interceptor, with the target being rather another fighter. It was an enemy bomber, in this case, the Soviet Bear and Badger.
Yes.
So I'd like your comment about that.
Well, I can speak from the F-4 and at that time frame. The Navy and Marine Corps F-4s didn't even have a gun on them, for example. Everything was missiles, Sidewinders and Sparrows, which were designed, the Sidewinder especially, to hit targets beyond visual range, or BVR they call it. And you had a radar interceptor officer in the back, and he would lock up a target, and you might fire on targets 5, 10, 15 miles away, never maybe see it visually. When you got in closer, you would use the Sidewinder, which was strictly a heat seeker, but no gun, not at all. Now, the Air Force, then eventually the Navy / Marine Corps did put a gun pod on the F-4, which looked like a big fuel tank underneath the airplane with a gun in that pod, but they just weren't that accurate. The Air Force about that time went to an internal gun with their F-4s. They bought new F-4s with guns, internal gun, which was like the World War II fighter with a gun. But it still wasn't that much gunfight, and it was mostly with missiles, even against other fighters.
You had mentioned that you luckily did not run into any MiGs while you were there, but you had heard about their tactics. And this is, Dwight, you touched upon this in your book. The general also said that the North Vietnamese pilots were by the book. They were controlled more by ground controllers than they were by their own whims when they took off.
Yeah, and what was really fascinating was they were using their aircraft, the MiG-17 and MiG-21s, were technically inferior to the F-4 Phantom, and they were using the World War II tactics that were rigidly Soviet based, but they were still knocking our pilots out of the sky, which was really, an astonishing thing. It was really hard to accept, what the heck's going on here? And it was simply a fact, I'm perhaps oversimplifying it, by saying we were fighting a different aerial war than the North Vietnamese were. General, would you agree with that?
Yeah, in fact, the Sparrow missiles, initially in Vietnam, many times they would fire, but they wouldn't track. So there was a lot of trouble, even with the missiles not being up to par and doing what they should do. And also, again, they would use those hit-and-run tactics. I disagree with you a little bit on one area. The MiG-21 was a pretty good airplane. The advantage that the MiG-21 had is it was very small, and it was hard to see. Whereas, in fact, we had a MiG-21 that had been captured or flown by one of the Arab Air Forces that the United States government got a hold of, and they showed a video of the F-4 and the MiG-21 flying beside each other from a distance. And you could see the F-4 coming. They're together. You see them see the F-4 coming, because the F-4 also left a smoke trail, which the MiG-21 did not. And it wasn't until they got fairly close that you even saw the MiG-21 next to the F-4. So it was a pretty good airplane in that respect, whereas the F-4, again, was easy to see and because of that smoke trail and didn't have a gun.
Okay. Well, hey, that's all right. I'm glad I got that correction in there, because we got a correction by a phone call. Came in from Rosie the Riveter. group Nancy from the Rosie River group at Willow Run said there were 8,600 B-24s constructed out of the 16,000 that were built in America during World War II. There were no B-17s built at Willow Run.
Right. 8,600
were
at
built
at Willow Run?
At Willow Run alone.
Oh, wow. I didn't know it was that many. I thought
That's
it was 5,000.
Right. Well, Nancy, thank you very much for giving us a call.
And
correcting our information here.
Right.
One of the things, Dwight, that I couldn't find when we're talking about now getting into the Top Gun era, I can't seem to locate it in your book right now, is that the kill ratio of American fighter pilots to enemy fighter pilots was very high during World War II. Somewhere in the neighborhood, I forget exactly what it was, but that you found that when we got to the Vietnam era, it had dropped down precipitously down to almost 2.5 to 1. And that's generated the change.
At its peak, it was like 20 to 1 in World War One. World War Two. I'm sorry. And in Korea, it was like 12 to 1. And then in Vietnam, it dropped to 2.5 to 1, which, needless to say, that kind of attrition, is unacceptable.
Right, yes. And so that's when the Navy sat down and decided to make some changes.
And this is really tough because they had already set up and bought into the whole interceptor concept, which we the general was very good at describing. And now they had to completely rethink how they were going to conduct aerial combat and basically turned the F-4 into a dogfighter, which it really wasn't designed to be.
Right, right.
And that's where, Lieutenant Commander Peterson, he was given the open book to create what became known as the Top Gun Fighter Pilot Training Program.
Right. General Henderson mentioned that he missed going to Top Gun by 2 weeks.
We were in a class to go out, four of us from my squadron, and we actually got out there, and then they turned right around and come back because something had happened, something logistics, they had to delay the class or something. I can't remember exactly what it was. This was in 1973, and so we ended up not going. We didn't make it.
Well, General, I would like to hear from your side what you were hearing about the Top Gun program. I've written about this historical thing, but you were there at the time, so you're hearing from the other pilots, so what was the feedback?
Oh, the Top Gun program was great. In fact, that turned everything around. I mean, it started the turnaround because now pilots were getting that additional training before they went to Vietnam, and the ratio did change after that. And also the Air Force started a school called Fighter Weapons School, which is equivalent of Top Gun. So both Top Gun covers the Navy and the Marine Corps, and, of course, the Air Force was Fighter Weapons at Nellis. Both first-class schools, and when you come out of there, you really know your aircraft and your weapon system. And you learn a lot about the adversary's aircraft. There's a lot of air-to-air work against smaller airplanes that are typical of what the adversary had. So it's a first-class school.
Well, the other thing that impressed me, too, was the students who graduated from Top Gun, they weren't just simply going to be the hotshot pilots. Their mandate was also to take the training that they received and pass it on others. Tell me about that, please.
Oh, yeah. When they come back to a squadron, they were many times put in positions where they become instructors in certain fields, and they had the corporate knowledge of what the rest of the pilots didn't have who hadn't been. So they did train and bring back knowledge that they learned at Top Gun, and it made everybody better. There's no question. It had an immediate effect. The ratio changed once these guys started going to Top Gun in the ratio of the kill ratio in Vietnam.
And you said as everybody's becoming a better and better pilot, and the aircraft were modified and changed?
Well, the F-4 wasn't really modified. It's hard to turn an airplane, modify an airplane to change it big time. But the new airplanes that started coming out after that were smaller. The F-16s were smaller. The F-14 was a big airplane. But they started making the airplane smaller. A lot of them went to single pilot instead of two crewmen. So that's the things they learned. That was a lot of a result of Top Gun. The F-4 was a big airplane. The MiG-21, for example, was a small airplane, but it was lethal.
The one thing that I was very fascinated about when I was doing my research was that the original Top Gun instructors, they they basically played test pilot with the F-4s,
right,
putting it through so many maneuvers and everything beyond the envelope, beyond what the manufacturer advised.
That's correct.
Can you tell me something about that that you knew about?
Well, when I first got in the F-4, for example, I was in a school. They'd had the F-4 maybe about 3 years when I got into it. But when I first got in the F-4, they were very hesitant to do overhead maneuvers in an F-4, like loops and things of that nature, because it was a heavy airplane, and if you didn't do it exactly right with certain parameters, you could lose control of the airplane. So it was not designed like the airplanes are now for all the to be as maneuverable as they are. So, but as time went on, when I finally got into the F-4, they started loosening up on what you could do with the airplane, because some of that is a result of Top Gun. As you said, they started doing things that hadn't been done in the airplane before, and they realized, well, we actually can do it and survive. So they taught methods to make you more effective as a fighter pilot, maneuvering the airplane to its maximum limits.
I like that.
A lot of things learned in Top Gun.
Yeah, I'm looking at we're talking with Dwight Zimmerman here, the author of Top Gun, the 50-year anniversary of naval air superiority, and his whole chapter here devoted to the Air Force's answer to Top Gun, which was called Red Flag.
Right.
Is what it is. And they're out there pretty close to where the Navy is, aren't they? As far
Red Flag's at Nellis Air Force Base in Las Vegas.
Okay.
Top Gun was out of Miramar down in San Diego, but now I think they've moved up to Lemoore because Miramar became a Marine air base.
Right. Yeah,
but they're both in the desert. Yeah.
Good, safe place to be. Not a lot of people you could run into.
Right.
Right now, Top Gun is at Fallon, which basically is right next door to Nellis.
Oh, okay.
All right, we've got about 5 minutes to go here, so I wanted to kind of skip ahead a little bit, if we can, to the stealth aircraft, and how do those aircraft compare at all with as far as fighters, from what you've learned, Dwight?
Oh, boy. This is a real new chapter, and that is, being written. The big difference is, of course, we don't have a human in the cockpit. It's instruments. The pilot, as it were, is sitting on a chair on the ground, in a trailer or wherever, as much as half a world away. Using his controls to put the aircraft through its paces, so it's not limited by the problems that the general knows about, blood rushing from the brain and other problems associated with just human body limitations. It's more mechanical. Wing is going to get ripped off, through a violent maneuver or stalling or whatever, can happen just from a mechanical standpoint.
You're talking about the drones here, right?
Right.
Yes. I think that that's going to be really interesting when you get two drone aircraft from opposite sides fighting. It's like a big video game.
Yeah,
only deadly for people.
And this is where it's going to be interesting to see what, the Top Gun movie sequel, mm-hmm. how it addresses that, because originally, that sequel was supposed to be out now, but because it's been working so closely with the Navy, they pushed back the release date a year, which is no small thing, given how much money is involved and everything. So that tells me that they are really investing in what's all happening with drone technology, drone tactics, and how that's going to play out.
It looks like I see another book in mind for you.
When is the second movie supposed to come out?
Uh, June of next year. Oh. It might be close to July. I think it's June 20th, something like that.
Well, that ought to be. I'm looking forward to that. That ought to be great. That ought to be something.
I got a feeling he likes to watch. Probably got Top Gun on his CD list. In his car and everything else. I was going to do that. I was going to do that earlier, and then I said no. I said we'll just sit there listening to the music. Well, all right. So the book is 50 years of Navy air superiority. Where can we get this, Mr. Zimmerman?
Well, thank you, Dale. Top Gun, 50 years of Navy air superiority can be purchased at any fine bookstore, and any bookstore that has it is definitely a fine bookstore, as well as Amazon and other online outlets.
I was going to say, including the bookstore on the USS Intrepid in New York Harbor.
Oh, yes. I had a great time there. So.
I can only imagine. And, of course, all your other books are available at these other fine bookstores, correct?
Yes.
Well, Dwight, I want to thank you very much for being on the program today. And I'm going to ask you a favor, if we could get a copy of your book signed by you that I could give to the general.
Oh, I'd be happy to, Dale.
I'll get you the information.
Yeah. And that's my pleasure. I'm honored, sir, and thank you for your service, and Dale, you as well. One of the things that I am humbled about is that I wind up having my skill set has been able to tell your guys' story.
Mm-hmm.
And Dale, you're familiar enough with it, and I'm just saying thank you to you guys. You are amazing individuals, and that I'm able to take my skill and help tell your stories to the larger audience. I feel that's my role as a bridge, to bring your stories to a civilian audience.
Well, we're most appreciative, and you do an excellent job of telling the story so that everybody can understand it, and not just military people. It's always exciting to see what you've got coming out next.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you in advance for writing the book, and then thank you in advance for me getting a copy of it. And I've really enjoyed talking to you.
Me too.
Okay, so we're coming up to the end of the hour here. I think I've got about a minute left or less. He's just nodding his head at me. I don't know.
Okay. Bye.
Dwight, thank you very much for being on the program. We'll be in touch. Let me know when when you've got another bestseller coming out.
Okay.
All right. And General Henderson, I want to thank you very much for being on our program today. General Henderson is a local young man. He's from the Ann Arbor area, went to Pioneer High School, Eastern Michigan University, and I want to welcome him for that. I want to remind everybody to tune in next week on Veterans Radio. We're going to be looking at post-traumatic stress treatments. You're dismissed.